Piper Kerman was a 24-year-old Smith College graduate in 1993 when she flew to Belgium with a suitcase of money intended for a West African drug lord. This misguided adventure started when she began a romantic relationship with a woman involved in a drug smuggling ring and got Kerman involved too, though Kerman left that life after several months. 5 years later, she was named as part of the drug ring, and in February 2008, she reported to the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. Kerman's memoir, Orange is the New Black, My Year in Women's Prison, inspired the award-winning Netflix television series of the same name. She will deliver the Alex Krieger Memorial Lecture at Vassar College on Tuesday, February 9th, in Poughkeepsie. The experience of being incarcerated not only inspired her memoir, but also her subsequent activism. Kerman serves on the board of the Women's Prison Association, an organization that provides preventative services for at-risk women, works to create alternatives to incarceration, and also offers programs to assist with re-entry into society. Again, the lecture is February 9th at Vassar College, and we welcome Piper Kerman to the roundtable this morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Very nice to have you on the program. When you do lectures like this, what is the message that you like to get out?
Well, I'm always honored to be included in a lecture series, especially one as esteemed as this, and it's great to be coming to Vassar for the first time ever. Whenever I talk to a college community, which I tend to assume has a lot of young people there, there are lots of things I'd like to emphasize about my own personal story in terms of, personal choices, personal responsibility. But of course, we're all actors within a much larger context. And so many of the questions that beset us as a society here in this country have to do with mass incarceration and its impact on communities. It's a very different impact on different communities. I always talk a lot about the kind of institutions that really make us safe, which include things like universities and public schools and libraries, and the institutions which too many people simply sort of assume are going to make us safe, like prisons and jails, when in fact the data shows something rather different. So those are just some of the things that I like to touch on. But of course, I also talk about, just what drove me to write the memoir, Orange is the New Black. And I talk about the show, the Netflix series, which has been adapted from the book.
At what point in your story, after serving the time, did you think that this would be something that you would want to write about and ultimately share with so many people?
Yeah, not everyone writes a memoir about the stupidest, most immoral thing they've ever done. I came home from prison in 2005. I was shocked by the things that I had learned about the criminal justice system during my own sort of, very twisty, turny bridge through it. And I was much more shocked by the treatment of people who are quite different than I am than I was by my own treatment by the criminal justice system. We, of course, incarcerate more of our people in this country than any society in human history has ever done before. And disproportionately, those people are from our poorest communities, and disproportionately, those people are from communities of color. And all you have to do is spend a little bit of time behind the walls of almost any prison or jail, and those realities will be very, very clear to just about anyone. So I came home from prison, and almost everyone that I knew wanted to know about the experience in as much detail as possible, because as an upper middle class white woman, there weren't that many people I knew who had been through the system. And so folks wanted to hear about what life is really like behind the walls. And it was really different than what I had assumed it would be like. And I thought that those things were important to talk about and to share. And I hoped that if I talked about my own experience and the things that I witnessed in sort of a pop culture way, that I might be able to get somebody to pick up a book about prison who wouldn't otherwise read a book about prison. And I thought that was important.
Those goals that you had for the book and in telling the story, do you believe that those are matched in the Netflix series?
The series is quite amazing in a host of ways to me. You know, we're at work on finishing the fourth season, and right. that's kind of unbelievable in its own right. The show obviously makes big departures from the true story that is told in the book. And part of that is because it's telling the story of so many more protagonists than you find in a book. Even though there's a real person who's called Pensatucky in my book, there's a real person who's called Crazy Eyes in the book. The characters in the show differ from those people in certain ways. And that's really necessary. What makes me very, very happy about what Jenji Kohan has done in the series is that it stays true to the themes in the book that are most important. And that is ultimately what's significant to me, not any kind of fealty to my own personal story, but rather a focus on race and class and gender and power and, you know, friendship and empathy and all of those things that are so important in the book. So that makes me really happy. And that's true season after season and episode after episode.
And that is brought out through really great writing and also beautiful acting.
Oh, I know. I'm just so grateful that a person like Jenji, who has a very provocative and very creative vision, wanted to do the project, and of course that attracted a lot of other very talented people to come and work on it, and I'm very grateful.
You serve on the board of the Women's Prison Association. It's an organization that provides services for at-risk women and ultimately works to create alternatives to incarceration. So two questions. One is, why do we not explore those alternatives more, and what are those alternatives?
Yeah, it's pretty mystifying, actually. In New York State, it costs generally around $60,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. And one of the programs that the Women's Prison Association operates is called Justice Home. And basically, women who are facing at least a year in prison, if not more, might get the option, if their district attorney and their judge agree, to go through this program, which keeps them at home with their kids, because the vast majority of these women have kids. And both, you know, pay back, you know, whatever their debt is to society, but also get the help they need, which might be substance abuse help, it might be mental health, it might be job training. There's different needs for different women and different families. That program costs about $18,000 a year compared with the 60. So there is a significant swath of our prison and jail population, which are much like any or most of the women who we choose to lock up. Low-level, nonviolent offenders, generally drug crimes or property crimes. And there are better ways to hold people accountable that also are not going to cost so much to taxpayers all over this country. So it's a good question why we aren't making better choices. New York has actually led the way in reducing our prison population, more than 20% reduction, and New York State has also led the nation in reduction of crime, both violent crime and property crime. And the astonishing thing that I think is so important for people to know is that states like New York and New Jersey and South Carolina and California that have reduced their prison populations the most have also been the states that have enjoyed the biggest reductions in crime at the same time. So we've long passed any point where prisons were making us safer, and I think actually we're at the point where just the opposite is happening. So it should be a big priority for folks to get people out of confinement in prison and jails who don't need to be there.
I think the thing, of course, about the story is the time frame of you graduating from college, from Smith College, and then having this actually the event happening in the early 90s and then the arrest coming in early 2000s of February 2004 when you went to the Federal Correction Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. If you had not gotten on that plane, flown to Belgium with a suitcase of money intended for a West African drug lord, what would you have been doing with your life? How much did it take you off track?
It's hard to know. You know, I entered the criminal justice system when I found out I had been indicted in 1998. So, you know, this has been dominating my life for a long time. I've been very fortunate. I've always been able to work in creative environments, You know, the opportunity to write the book is something I'm very, very grateful for. I've always been involved in storytelling and sort of the creative side of things. So my current work is teaching nonfiction writing in a men's prison and a women's prison in Ohio. And, you know, everyone that you find behind the walls of a prison or a jail has some sort of a complicated and often fascinating story that relates to their own life. And the idea that if more and more people are able to tell those stories and there are more and more platforms by which people can understand those stories, that's how I believe we begin to understand ourselves and each other better and make change.
I know that you work with programs that assist with reentry into society. Tell us a little bit about those programs and also about your own reentry and how hard that was for you.
I came home from prison and I had a lot of things working in my favor. First and foremost, I had a safe and stable place to live. This is the starting point for successful reentry and a huge challenge for many people. I knew a lot of women in prison who knew that they were going not home, but to a homeless shelter directly from prison or jail. So a safe, stable place to live is hugely important. Everyone can understand that. And the other thing that was so important is that the week after I came home from prison, I started a job. And I can't possibly overstate how important that job was. I wouldn't be talking to you today on the radio if I hadn't had that second chance at employment. And that's the number one thing that I hear about from other people who, like me, have a felony conviction, is that, you know, employment and getting a good job at a living wage is the biggest stumbling block to being successful at reentry. So we've made a lot of strides on this front in terms of something called fair hiring, or also called ban the box. New York City is the biggest municipality that has banned the box within, you know, city limits in terms of, you know, giving people a leg up on the very first steps of applying for a new job. So what ban the box basically means is that an employer, when they choose to offer a job to somebody, that's the appropriate point for them to start asking about any kind of criminal background or convictions that might be relevant to the job once they've actually decided that the person might be a good fit for them. It's pretty simple and straightforward. More and more states and municipalities are doing that. I can only tell you that from my own personal experience, if I had not known a guy who ran a company and was willing to take a chance on me, my entire life since 2005 would be completely different. That job coming home is so, so important.
As you mentioned, you work with both male and female prison populations. Is it more difficult for women when it comes to reentry?
Well, there are different challenges. So what we know about women prisoners, women and girls who end up in the criminal justice system, is that there's three really consistent things that drive their involvement in crime and their incarceration. And that is substance abuse, mental health problems, including full-blown mental illness sometimes, and an overwhelming preponderance of a history of sexual abuse or other physical abuse. About 90% of women who are in the system have been the victims of sexual violence or other forms of physical violence. And that kind of trauma then spills over into other parts of their lives. That's one of the big problems with incarcerating women, is that the experience of incarceration actually involves the threat of violence almost every single day. And so for women prisoners who are overwhelmingly survivors of that trauma, you know, people sometimes come out of prison in really bad shape. So that question of safety, and again, that question of particularly safe housing for women, is a very, very significant challenge. You know, the majority of women who come home from prison or jail have not necessarily been working in the mainstream economy. And so that is another big obstacle. And the other thing that is very significantly different for female prisoners or for women in the system is that the vast majority of them are moms, and most of those moms are the moms of minor children, kids under the age of 18. And so family reunification and getting their kids back is a primary concern for a lot of women coming out of the criminal justice system. We know that when we lock up a mom, her kids are five times more likely to go into the foster care system than when we lock up a dad. The loss of any parent into prison or jail is really devastating for a family, but we know that when it's a mom, it's particularly seismic.
Did you become affected? I mean, obviously, you're worried about yourself when you're in a facility, in a correctional institution. How much does it affect you of what is going on for the other women that you are being incarcerated with?
I mean, the experience of incarceration is very intentionally designed to be traumatizing. And everyone, you know, different people experience incarceration in different ways based on their past life and also based on their race and their class. But, you know, every single person has a number instead of a name, at least in theory, and every single person is dressed in an identical uniform. And so you'd have to be pretty clueless not to recognize the incredibly important things that you have in common with the other people who are going through that experience with you. And what I found when I was incarcerated is that those things that, you know, that each person has in common, that we almost all have in common, were far more important than the things that made us different in terms of our shared survival.
As you mentioned, season 4 of Orange is the New Black will be coming to Netflix, I believe, at the beginning of the summer. How much do you know about the coming season? How much are you allowed to say? And is that involvement exactly what you want it to be?
I am a consultant on the show, and what that means, very simply, is that I answer questions when they come up, and those could be questions about anything from probation to family court questions to robbing banks. You know, I've never robbed a bank, so when those kinds of questions come up, I generally say, well, I know someone else who can answer.
let's Google that. Sure.
I do read the scripts, so and I visit the set as often as I'm able to. It's always really fun to see all the cast members. I can promise that we have a very, very exciting season 4 coming up, but I can't offer any more spoilers.
Well, we don't want you to spoil it, so that works out just fine. Piper Kerman's memoir, Orange is the New Black, My Year in Women's Prison, inspired the award-winning Netflix television series of the same name. She will deliver the Alex Krieger 95 Memorial Lecture at Vassar College on Tuesday, February 9th, in Poughkeepsie on the second floor of the Students' Building. It is a free and open to the public event, vassar.edu, vassar.edu for more information. Piper Kerman, thank you very much for being on the program and for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it. Be great to have you in the region.
Nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, Piper Kerman at Vassar College for the Alex Krieger Memorial Lecture on Tuesday, February 9th in Poughkeepsie, vassar.edu for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.